Hello, and welcome to Ramblings with a Medical Historian. I'm your host, Nicole Curry, and this is a podcast where I ramble on about medical history. I look at strange practices, common misconceptions, and medicine throughout history. I also talk about some interesting Canadian and local history. This is Season 2, Episode 7. So let's continue to talk about residential schools. To start, I would like to warn you once again that the topic we are going to be discussing contains things that may be triggering to some individuals. We will be discussing the kidnapping and abuse of children and the genocide that was the residential school system. This will be a very heavy topic. There is a 24-hour crisis hotline. Former residential school students can call 1-866-925-4419 for emotional crisis referral services and information on other health supports from the Government of Canada. Indigenous people across Canada can also go to the Hope for Wellness Helpline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for counseling and crisis intervention. Call the toll-free helpline at 1-855-242-3310 or connect to the online chat. I have put a link to the helplines in the show notes, as well as a link to more information to begin your learning journey and learn about the Indigenous peoples of Canada. And lastly, I would like to acknowledge that I am a settler. I live between the Batchewana First Nations and the Garden River First Nation Reserve on Robertson-Huron Treaty Territory. The Indigenous people of North America have been here for over 30,000 years. It behooves us to acknowledge and study Indigenous history. Today, I will be discussing the Canadian Indian residential school system that has had great intergenerational impacts. So, we left off at the turn of the 20th century. We discussed how in 1904, Minister Sir Clifford Sifton announced the closure of industrial schools in favor of boarding schools. They were closed over the next two decades. The government and churches found it better to keep the children separated from their families so as not to compromise their education and reintroduce Indigenous teachings, beliefs, languages, or culture. So let us continue to look at what happened during the 20th century. Originally, the residential school system focused on industrial labor schools and farm schools. By 1900, there were 22 industrial schools and 39 residential schools in Canada. In 1904, Dr. Peter Bryce was appointed medical inspector to the departments of the Interior and Indian Affairs. In 1907, Dr. Bryce visited 35 schools. He reported the appallingly unsanitary conditions, microorganism-bearing ventilation, high death rates, and, quote, the almost invariable cause is tuberculosis. Here's another quote from that time. The appalling number of deaths among the younger children brings the department within unpleasant nearness to the charge of manslaughter. Honorable S.H. Blake, K.C., Chair of Advisory Board on Indian Education, partner in what is now the national law firm Blake, Kessel, and Graydon, to Minister Frank Oliver. In 1908, Indian Affairs accountant F.H. Paget reported that the school buildings were in bad condition. 1909, Duncan Campbell Scott was appointed Superintendent of Indian Education. In 1910, we have this quote, I can safely say that barely half of the children in our Indian schools survive to take advantage of the education we are offering them, said Scott to Major D.M. McKay, Indian Affairs Agent General in B.C. The children, quote, catch the disease in a building burdened with tuberculosis, bacilli, said Duck Lake Indian Agent MacArthur. In 1913, Scott was appointed Deputy Superintendent General of Indian Affairs, or Deputy Minister, reporting to the Minister of the Interior and Superintendent General, Dr. William A. Roche. In 1919, the position of Medical Inspector for Indian Agencies and Residential Schools was abolished in the year of the Spanish flu by order in council on the recommendation of Scott, quote, for reasons of economy. The government began purchasing church-run boarding schools in the 1920s. During this period, capital costs associated with the schools were assumed by the government, leaving the administrative and instructional duties to the church officials. The hope was that minimizing facility expenditures would allow church administrators to provide higher quality instruction and support to students in their care. Although the government was willing to, and did, purchase the schools from the churches, many were acquired for free given that the rampant disrepair present in the buildings resulted in their having no economic value. Schools continued to be maintained by churches in instances where they failed to reach an agreement with government officials, with the understanding that the government would provide support for capital costs. The understanding ultimately proved complicated due to the lack of written agreements outlining the extent and nature of the support or the approvals required to undertake expensive renovations and repairs. April 1st, 1920. Residential schools became mandatory. Deputy Superintendent General of Indian Affairs, Duncan Campbell Scott, made attendance at residential schools mandatory for every Indigenous child between the ages of 7 and 16. This policy was also inconsistently applied to Métis and Inuit children. In 1920, we have this quote from Duncan Campbell Scott. If you didn't already know that he was a horrible person, this just reinforces it. So, I quote, "I want to get rid of the Indian problem," said Duncan Campbell Scott to Parliamentary Committee. The amendment to the Indian Act by Scott that made the schools mandatory stipulated no particular kind of school. However, Scott favored residential schooling to eliminate the influence of home and reserves and hasten assimilation. January 1st, 1922. The story of a national crime was published. Dr. Peter Henderson Bryce publishes The Story of a National Crime, being an appeal for justice to the Indians of Canada, the wards of the nation, our allies in the Revolutionary War, our brothers in arms in the Great War. Exposing the Canadian government's suppression of information on the health of Indigenous peoples. It was in 1922 that this was published. Bryce argued that Duncan Campbell Scott and the Ministry of Indian Affairs neglected Indigenous health needs and noted a criminal disregard for the treaty pledges. He found that from the years 1894 to 1908, within 5 years of entry, 30 to 60% of students had died, an avoidable mortality rate. Had healthy children not been exposed to the children with tuberculosis, a, quote, trail of disease and death has gone on almost unchecked by serious efforts on the part of the Department of Indian Affairs. His 1907 recommendations on tuberculosis control not given effect, he says, owing to the active oppression by Mr. Duncan Campbell Scott. In 1923, residential schools was adopted as the official term, replacing the terms boarding and industrial schools. They housed roughly 5,347 children. Before 1925, the Methodist Church also operated residential schools. However, when the United Church of Canada was formed in 1925, most of the Presbyterian and all Methodist schools became United Church schools. By the 1930s, government officials recognized that the residential school system was financially unstable and failing to meet the intended goal of training and assimilating Indigenous children into European Canadian society. January 1st, 1930, the residential school network expands. More than 80 institutions were in operation across Canada, the most at any one time. With an enrollment of over 17,000, the Roman Catholic Church operated 3/5 of the schools, the Anglican Church 1/4, and the United and Presbyterian Churches the remainder. The residential schools often maintained industrial work through large gardens, barns, workshops, and sewing rooms. Funding was enrollment-based and very parsimonious. Living conditions became crowded and less healthy. Children arrived already suffering from tuberculosis and other illnesses. When children died at the schools, they were seldom sent home for proper burial. The government wouldn't, and the churches couldn't pay for that, nor could the families. So instead, it was shallow graves and wooden crosses in the fields outside the schools. And though the education was generally good and gratefully received by some, record keeping or the successful preservation of records was remarkably bad. The little wooden crosses and cemetery fences, of course, are long gone, hence the uncertainty as to numbers and names and even locations of those buried. If you are and have been following the news in Canada, you can see that the residential schools across Canada are looking for the unmarked graves of the children who were buried at those residential schools. And although we did know that the children were buried there, we did not, I think, perhaps more, I'm speaking a little bit more on the European side of things, we did not realize the sort of vast numbers of children that were buried at these residential schools. These children that were never able to go home. In 1932, Scott retired as Deputy Superintendent General after more than 52 years in the department. The anthologist John Garvin wrote that Scott's, quote, policy of assimilating the Indians had been so much in keeping with the thinking of the time that he was widely praised for his capable administration. He embodied a fundamental contradiction. While a rigid and often heartless bureaucrat, quote, his sensibilities as a poet were saddened by the waning of an ancient culture, a quote from the Canadian Encyclopedia. January 1st, 1934. Inuit education research was conducted by the federal government. For the first time, the Canadian government conducted research into Inuit education. J. Lorne Turner, Director of Lands, Northwest Territories and Yukon Branch for the Department of the Interior, urged the government to provide formal education to Inuit children. February 15th, 1936. Report of the Royal Commission appointed to investigate the conditions of the Métis population in Alberta. In December 1934, the Alberta government appointed Albert Freeman Ewing to report on Métis living conditions. The report indicated that 80% of Métis children in Alberta received no education. The report suggested building schools for Métis children. In 1939, 9,027 children were in 79 residential schools run by Catholic, which was about 60%, Anglican, about 25%, and United and Presbyterian churches making up the rest. Quote, 1939 was the approximate midpoint of the history of the system, from John S. Milloy, a national crime. Robert Huey, Superintendent of Welfare and Training in the Indian Affairs Branch of the Federal Department of Mines and Resources, opposed the expansion of new schools, noting in 1936 that, quote, to build educational institutions, particularly residential schools, while the money at our disposal is insufficient to keep the schools already erected in proper state of repair, is to me very unsound and a practice difficult to justify. He proposed the expansion of day schools, an approach to educating Indigenous children that he would continue to pursue after being promoted to Director of Welfare and Training Branch in 1945. The proposal was resisted by the United Church, the Anglican Church, and the missionary oblates of Mary Immaculate, who believed the solution to the system's failure was not reconstruction, but intensification. 1944. Consensus developed among senior Indian Affairs officials that integration into provincial systems should replace segregated Aboriginal education. January 1st, 1948. Thunderchild Indian Residential School was destroyed. 4 students were investigated for arson. Others reportedly cheered as they watched their school burn. This was one of the dozen fires set by students as a form of resistance at residential schools across the country. Between 1945 and 1955, the number of First Nations students in day schools run by Indian Affairs expanded from 9,532 to 17,947. This growth in student population was accompanied by an amendment to the Indian Act in 1951 that allowed federal officials to establish agreements with provincial and territorial governments and school boards regarding the education of Indigenous students in the public school system. These changes marked the government's shift in policy from assimilation-driven education at residential schools to the integration of Indigenous students into public schools. It was believed that Indigenous children would receive a better education as a result of their transition into public school system. So, we will leave off there. I hope you have learned something today. And if you would like to know more or see the sources that I used, you can find them on my website that is linked in the show notes or the episode description. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me at Ramblings with a Medical Historian on Facebook and Instagram, or send me an email to ramblings.mh@gmail.com. Follow me on my socials to stay up to date with the episodes. Thank you for listening, and remember, keep rambling on.